Welcome back to Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers, the podcast devoted to exploring the frontiers of psychedelic medicine and what it takes to cultivate a healthy mind, body, and spirit. As always, Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous. I'm Dr. Steve Thayer, and today my co-host Dr. Reed Robison and I discuss the potential pitfalls of making your problems your identity. We explore the pros and cons of diagnostic labels, growth versus fixed mindset, post-traumatic growth, spiritual bypassing, human being versus human doing, the dialectic tension between self-acceptance and self-improvement, and much, much more. Couple of announcements before we get into the show. If you're looking for professional training pursuant to becoming a psychedelic assisted practitioner, check out the courses we offer here at Numinous. You can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/training, and you can use the code PTF10 for 10% off selected trainings. If you've listened to the show for a while, you've heard Reed and I talk a lot about the psychedelic clinical trial work that Numinous does. If you or someone you know is interested in being a participant in psychedelic clinical trial, you can click on the link in the show notes or go directly to numinous.com/research to learn more about the trials we're currently running. Finally, if you'd like to support us, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so by leaving a review or a rating in places like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you're listening to the show on YouTube, please like the video, subscribe to the channel, and share the episode with somebody you think needs to hear it. Without further ado, here's today's episode. So Reed, today I thought I'd start with the lyrics from a song that I really like. It's called Unfolding by Luca Fogel, I think that's how you say.
I like that song as well.
Yeah. So this is just the first verse and the chorus. Am I getting that right?
Let's hear it.
All right. I'm not going to sing it, but let me out. The wires are all showing. Sleight of hand is slowing. Everything explained. Further now from anything absolving, nothing left to solve and nothing left to say. In time, untraced, any part of this still holding. I am not breaking. I am not broken. I am unfolding. And I remember the first time I heard that song, it was actually being played by a friend of ours during an ayahuasca ceremony, and it freaking wrecked me.
Yeah, I remember that.
And I listened to it, a couple times during my own integration process, and it always had me in tears. And it was this concept of, I am not breaking, I am not broken, I am unfolding. I'm thinking about that a lot recently, because I've got several clients right now who feel like deep down inside they are broken, you know, that they are sick, they are unwell, and they've wrapped their identity around this idea that you know, they have this fundamental flaw. And so they need to fix it. And there's this belief that if they do, then they will be well. And if they're well, they will never suffer. And they won't, you know, and it sounds fairly irrational, but I have a lot of compassion for that belief, right? Mm-hmm. You know, we are in the mental health care field. People come to us feeling very broken. And we have treatments and strategies to help them feel more whole. But I thought it might be useful to kind of talk about this concept of over-identification with the labels, over-identification with our problems, mm-hmm. because it produces in some people almost like an addiction to the healing process, where they just sort of go from one treatment, one seminar, one psychedelic experience to the next, and never really settling into what one might call a more growth mindset. Right, they just sort of get stuck in this fixed mindset.
Yeah, it's a fine line, isn't it? That what we call in DBT a dialectic of I'm doing the best I can, perfectly okay as is, and yes, there are things I need to work on. Mm-hmm. And that middle path is not easy to follow. And when you were talking about getting stuck in that identity of being broken, I was just thinking about how we as a mental health field are sometimes part of the problem, mm-hmm. with the fueling the over-identification with excessive labels.
And I think it comes from a good place, yeah. Right? I mean, we want to, for a long time, the idea that these mental health challenges were actually mental illnesses, that they were legitimate, that they were real things, was not in vogue. And there's been a lot of effort to, you know, validate what's going on for people psychologically. Like, this is a real thing. And you'd hear people say things like, your depression is as real as if you had cancer, right? It's a brain disease. This is a mental illness. Again, mm-hmm. in an effort not to lock people down with an identity, but
to combat the stigma.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is interesting to look at these days with this, the stigma that still exists in certain parts of the population in big ways, but also in, especially in the younger generation, this stigma has almost reduced so much, which is great. But it does open the door for this risk of getting attached to something or searching for answers outside of ourselves.
Yeah. So we're in our, you know, best Steve Thayer, Rita Robinson way, trying to proceed with caution here and talking about this. We're not trying to invalidate the very real realities of people's individual suffering or the great scientific work that's been done to show that, you know, these are very real things that happen to us. It's not quote unquote, just all in our head. We're not making it up. They aren't weaknesses necessarily. Mm-hmm. They're not character defects or flaws.
Yeah. You know, what comes to mind as an example is PTSD. Mm. You know, we work a lot with PTSD, of course. And for years, even in the past, I worked at this kind of really lovely nonprofit clinic in Salt Lake called Utah Health and Human Rights with torture victim refugees. And at the time, human trafficking victims. And we had to stop working with human trafficking when I was there because, you know, the SWAT team or the FBI ended up needing to come into the clinic one too many times, and it just had to be kind of separated out. Mm. But the it was the worst trauma I'd ever heard of as I sat there and kind of bore witness to people's stories of terror. But when we look at PTSD, most humans in this country experience trauma, 60%+, depending on how you define it. And we could look more at some of those numbers, but only about, 10 to 15% of people in this country develop PTSD only. That's a lot. But there's trauma and then there's PTSD. But even if you have a significant trauma that turns into PTSD, the goal is to get to the other side of it, mm-hmm. right? The goal isn't to have PTSD once and for all or to embody an identity of PTSD forever. It's essentially a tool to understand yourself and access the right healing modalities for you, ideally, mm-hmm. and go for the cure, which can be a bit of a dirty word in mental health, cure.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember in the military looking at some of those PTSD numbers and, I don't know if this is still the case, but when I was in the Air Force, the majority of the PTSD diagnoses among active duty military personnel were in people who had never seen combat. So these are people who may have had proximity to combat, mm-hmm. but, a lot of them were receiving PTSD, delayed PTSD diagnoses from, you know, childhood trauma or other things. We've talked on the show about post-traumatic growth before, and I was referencing the science. I mean, the still, I would say, limited, but also impressive brain science that we have shows that, like, literal things change in your limbic system when you're traumatized to the extent that you qualify for a PTSD diagnosis. So maybe I'm being overcautious here. I do want to pay respects to the very realities of the struggles that people have, but it's also part of what we're trying to do, like you're saying, to help people is to, you know, empower them. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's empowering to receive a diagnosis like, oh, there's a thing that, that other people experience this thing. It's been identified in research and there's been treatments that have been, created based on that good research mm-hmm. and this common experience that people have. But again, there are pitfalls in over-identifying with a label and considering yourself broken or disabled.
Yeah, and we won't go on this tangent, but just to mention Alcoholics Anonymous, for example, and addiction as an identity, there are pros and cons of that, and it's a debate. I could see both sides mm-hmm. and participate in both sides of the debate of, hello, my name is whatever, and I'm a fill in the blank, alcoholic. And if you say that forever, one, you're protecting yourself from potentially some triggers and risks of relapse by staying hypervigilant. But on the other hand, you're staying in a kind of wounded, struggling place of, I am an addict, whether it's 20 or 30 years later. And I think the real question is, what does that mean for you if you say that?
Right.
Yeah. How does it spill into your life? Yeah.
Right. I've seen people relate to that differently. You know, I mean, I had a graduate student or graduate school instructor once who would try to make this point by saying, you know, I had this client who came in very, very visibly depressed. And the only time I ever saw him smile in treatment was when I told him, you're depressed. And he's like, you're right. I'm depressed. And so you even see it in the language. And we've, in the field, in the mental health field, have tried to move away from like things like, oh, she's borderline. She isn't borderline. It's not who she is. She happens to qualify for this diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, but it's not who she is.
Yeah.
And, you know, people going through addiction treatment will sometimes instead think, not I am an addict, that's not who I am, but I have a tendency to addiction to this certain thing or this certain substance. Sorry, it's a thing about me.
I had this, I went through this, I have this predisposition.
Predisposition, yeah. It's a thing about me, it's not who I am.
Like, moving back to the PTSD example, the genetic risk of PTSD is thought to be somewhere around 30% of the risk of a trauma turning into PTSD being attributable to your DNA. And that's on the low end for mental health conditions, but I'd say all of them land somewhere in the 30 to 70 or 80%, like the autism spectrum disorders, like especially like classically defined autism and related conditions, those ones would be on the higher end of the spectrum, you know, looking at twin studies, and could be highly genetic, and depression, ADHD, somewhere in the middle, but like half and half. But the point is like you pointed out, we have this predisposition to certain things, and that can be ammo, protectively for our journey. Good self-awareness content, depending on how you use it, or it could also be a trap that we can get stuck in, like that, that Ram Dass saying we've been talking about lately of all tools can become traps. Mm-hmm. And I think diagnoses you could look at that way. But in order for, Ram Dass goes on to say, and this is really interesting, in order for the tool to work, it needs to become a trap. Wonder what you think of that. I don't think it's universally true, but I think there's a pretty cool lesson embedded in there.
I'm not sure what that means. So in order for a tool to work, it needs to become a trap?
Yeah. So this one gets kind of obscure, but say you, we like to joke about hape habits that some people have. Hape, like that sacred snuff, ash.
Tobacco-based.
Yeah, with nicotine. And so depending on the blend, there may be little or a lot of nicotine, and some people do report feeling a pull to it, but for a tool, some people use it as a tool to get them into meditation, but then as it's becoming a trap, I'll see if this example works or not. I'm just making it up, but in order for it to work, it needs to get you into meditation. And from a big picture standpoint, you know, you shouldn't need a tool or a carrot eventually, things like that. But once you see it having a grip on you, or see that, oh, why is this going into my life, into my nose? Why is this needed for my meditation? You start to, if you have a sense of awareness of that, you start to shed that tool, like the skin of a snake, for example, and realize you don't need it to go into that meditation. You let it go, let it fall off, and carry on without, whether you use the thing or a thing or not. But tools like need to start to become a trap so we can transcend them.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was thinking. Those listening, if they're a stimulus for evolution, But maybe you need to realize the trap that they've become so that you can shed that skin and evolve.
Which can take a while, and we all certainly have blind spots. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about like that kind of embodied stance of awareness and questioning that that we like to try on of like, why is this in my life? Why is this substance going into my body? Mm-hmm. Why is this mushroom, you know, going into me? Like, what's my intention for consuming it?
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. So sometimes I like to think of those tools and the questioning that you're describing. Well, I guess to say it a different way, if you can ask yourself, does this tool or does this seminar or does this thing, is it helping me run away from something or is it helping me engage in something, mm-hmm. right? Is it helping me feel more at peace in my body so that I can engage with my family more, you know, so that I can do the hard thing that was too hard for me otherwise? Mm-hmm. Or is it just helping me run away from something that's really, really hard?
And taking you away from your values, like family, for example. Mm-hmm. And I think we mentioned it in a very recent conversation on here of like sometimes we as humans are at risk of bouncing from one, say, psychedelic retreat or ceremony to the next for chasing that outpouring of bliss. But a question maybe in our integration chat, I think, around that is, you know, it's one thing to feel an outpouring of bliss during a psychedelic ceremony, but does it change how you show up in your day-to-day life? Does that outpouring of love that you felt there translate into you being able to give and receive love more freely and fully in life?
Yeah. Right, right. Can you use that transient psychedelic state to forge a more durable psychological trait?
Altered states for altered traits.
Yeah, I've noticed that. It reminds me of the concept of the spiritual bypass that we talk about in our courses. We've talked about it here a couple mm-hmm. times. A concept, at least by my research, first introduced by this Buddhist psychotherapist, John Wellwood, in the 80s. This idea of to use his words, a tendency to use spiritual ideas and practices to sidestep or avoid facing unresolved emotional issues, psychological wounds, unfinished developmental tasks. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, you kind of see it in the way you described people going from one ecstatic experience to the next. And you'll see people back to the identity conversation, whose identity is not only sort of captured by their wounds, but is also captured by being in the healing process.
Yeah.
So we all have things that we need to heal. I'm on a healing journey. And that's, I think, true in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But I think we can get too preoccupied with needing to be healed. And then this concept of human being versus human doing that we've talked about on the show before, I think, comes to mind. Mm-hmm. The difference in some ways being, you know, can you be who you are with self-compassion and self-acceptance, all your flaws and all your strengths? And can you rest in that? And can your calling in life, your purpose, your connections, your relationships emanate from that self-accepting place? Or are you human doing? Are you obsessed with productivity? Are you obsessed with accumulation of always needing to be better or the best or winning?
Yeah. These are very important questions to self-reflect on. And this is slightly related, but as you're talking about it, I'm remembering an analogy that I may have shared on here before, but if so, it's been like a year or more. Mm-hmm. But it's from a Buddhist teacher and writer who I really like named Shinzen Young. He wrote The Science of Enlightenment, really good book. But in there somewhere, he gives the analogy of consciousness being like a three-layer cake. And the first time I read this, I was like, oh, that sounds like the psychedelic journey work. But the surface of the cake, the frosting, is normal everyday waking consciousness. And as we do our work, psychedelic work, personal development work, whatever it is, you dive in to the layer under that. And So there's three layers in this analogy. The one in the middle there has a lot of potential distractions, like psychedelic fireworks, bells and whistles, or skeletons in the closet, old stuff, unfinished business to clean out, etc. Things that you naturally do need to pass through, like you're coming up on a journey, or you're doing this, you're doing some kind of emotional deep dive on your healing and really having some fireworks go on in your head of how this can, you know, improve your life, etc. There is a risk of staying there, or your deep dive trajectory towards the core of the cake, which is the core of, say, self-realization, self-actualization, God, if you will, source. There's a risk of getting stuck in and playing in the either the closet or the circus of interesting things and not continuing on that vector of your trajectory towards source, you know?
Yeah. I think I've in my life, there've been periods of time where I've been stuck in that second layer because I'm a very curious person. I'm also kind of neurotic by disposition. I like to overthink and figure things out, collect information. So as I'm reflecting on that metaphor, I've seen my clients in this space too, where they have to go from one book to one podcast to one therapist to one coach to another because they feel like they need to figure everything out first before they take action, maybe. And they get stuck in this sort of analysis paralysis.
And sometimes we humans are doing some of the superficial work without doing the homework, which is actually where the rubber meets the road in the transformation. Let's say you're doing your weekly therapy or coaching and getting all this cool insight in an hour each week or whatever frequency, but do you take that into day-to-day life? It's kind of like integration with anything. Do you weave it into your daily? Do you do the grunt work? Do you take the garbage out after you've spotted it, or do you let it kind of pile up and or stuff it away in a closet?
Yeah, I could probably accuse myself of being trying to avoid the label here, but insight addict before, somebody who is really, really loves the feeling of the eureka feeling, like aha, interesting, but then not doing the integration part.
Yeah, I mean, me too, and maybe we're all on that spectrum somewhere.
I think it's a spectrum, though,
I think about, like, I like to write and journal and take notes, and I think about this stack of notebooks I have at home full of nuggets of golden science, energy, and wisdom like that, And sure, I try to revisit and try to integrate, but how much of that has been unintegrated by sitting there as I've, you know, scribbled the next thing or gone off to try and learn the next thing without applying some of the other important core, potentially very useful truths.
Yeah, I've certainly had that experience too, reading an old journal entry and discovering like, oh, I've actually already thought about this thing years ago. I even had like an idea of how to address it years ago.
Like, oh, here we go again.
But life is like that, right? We're on sort of this circular upward spiral. We revisit things over and over again, and that's okay.
And, go ahead.
We just want to reiterate your point. Like we want to try to avoid the trap of, sort of skimming the surface of the insight and not slowing down, going deep. Getting to that third layer.
The deep work is some of the most uncomfortable, and it's natural to reflex, recoil, shy away from the discomfort, of course. That's what we do. But, and like you said something about like being at risk for getting stuck, like we all are in that middle layer of curiosities. But I just wanted to point out that, like, who decides what is stuck and what is patiently working through the middle layer of curiosities, right? And that's a personal thing. And the stuff we're talking about, like a lot of stuff we talk about, doesn't have crystal clear black and white answers, especially one size fits all.
Yeah. You know, it reminds me of our adult development episode in conversation. Like, what might it feel like to be stuck in that middle layer? How might we distinguish between stuckness and just, as you described, sort of patiently going through and productively working on our stuff? Mm-hmm. I think a couple of maybe telltale signs are repeating similar patterns, either thinking, feeling, or behavior patterns over and over and over again, and finding yourself frustrated, really, really frustrated by the lack of perceived progress. And mm-hmm. maybe I should put air quotes around progress, because it implies the sort of linear trajectory, this upward linear trajectory. And I don't know that life is often like that, but
it's spiral dynamics instead.
Yeah. But I feel like, just to self-disclose even more, I'm in a place in my life where I feel more settled, like the sediment, maybe the cement on the foundation is finally dry, and there's still lots to be built on top of it. But there's a greater sense of who I am, what I'm here to do. And it feels like I believe it more than I ever have. And so, it allows me to express and act more from a place of security rather mm-hmm. than getting preoccupied with, oh, I got to fix this, I got to heal this before I can go about my calling in the world or something like that.
Oh, that's really interesting. And I have a question for you, because, you know, this topic I think intrigues us both. Mm-hmm. Adult development, not only waking up, but growing up, doing the work. And I'm wondering, it's probably an unanswerable question, but how much of that settled place you find yourself in do you think is from just reaching a certain age of maturity mm-hmm. versus doing the work?
Yeah, I have thought about that. I think it's, you know, this will maybe an unsatisfying answer, but it is a little bit of both.
Yeah.
My wife and I were talking the other day just about, we were going through some old pictures of our kids when they were very young. And she was reminding me, because, you know, as a husband and a father, and the, I forgot some of these things, but she was reminding me about how hard life was for us back then mm-hmm. when the kids were young, when she was trying to nurse these fussy babies that were allergic to everything and couldn't latch mm-hmm. on, and just the torture that was for her, and how I was gone all the time because I was in graduate school or I was in the military. And I wasn't like because it's just the developmental stage in our life, I don't think I had access or it was even available to me to be as settled as I am now. And, you know, she's also likes to remind me that I'm a very different man now than I was when I was in my 20s or early 30s. And I think some of that is just by virtue of getting older, mm-hmm. Accumulating experience, maybe entering into a different developmental stage myself. But I think it's also a product of a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah. Which comes with the territory of hopefully of mm-hmm. being human and at whatever pace you do it at. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think like you said earlier, the disclaimer of, a lot of compassion for anyone on this path, because kudos, like high fives and a whole lot of like empathy and understanding for this is, it's hard to be human and it's hard to heal. It's hard to grow. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this stuff is extremely uncomfortable, but part of the life trajectories we talk about in adult development happen because, we as humans tend to not stay completely stagnant and stuck forever. And there is a trajectory of growth as we develop from little babies through teens and adulthood. And adulthood's, I think, just one of the risky territories for slowing down that work to a crawl space or not knowing where to go with it.
Yeah. Yeah, again, it's back to your point about balance. Because I think a lot of us continue to press, and maybe this is a sort of normal thing about human minds, but we have a tendency not to be very satisfied. Like we acclimate to where we are in life pretty quickly in some cases. And it's responsible for our continued growth as a species and all the things we've developed, because we just can't be satisfied mm-hmm. with where we are. But I like the idea of whether it's a healing journey or a personal development journey or a self-discovery journey. I like the idea of it being motivated by curiosity, on a foundation of self-compassion.
Yeah.
And it feels very different than this foundation of I'm deficient, that there are these missing puzzle pieces that I need to put into place. And once I do, like I said at the beginning of the show, I'll be happy and without problems.
I like that. I like that kind of question or stance to be in of self-reflection and asking yourself, do I feel content with me as a person as I'm going about doing this work to for the betterment of me as a person and my values, goals, hopes and dreams and community, family, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And because it would be very different. The energy of it is very different if you're coming at it from a frantic, I need to plug a hole, I need to fix a broken thing versus, okay, let's do this sustainably, patiently, but proactively, this work to just grow even more.
Yeah.
To unfold even more.
To unfold. And maybe we should say sometimes there's a hole that needs to be plugged. You know, if you're in a psychotic break and you need immediate treatment, or if you're acutely suicidal and or if you have, you know, you're on your deathbed because of an uncontrolled eating disorder, it's like that can be an emergency. And couching that in this concept of unfolding might seem difficult, but...
And part of, you mentioned psychosis, just to use that as an example for comparison. When we were talking about the mental health field contributing in many ways, obviously, to the overdiagnosis, over-identification issue that we've talked about, it's therefore, like you pointed out, a reason, like 1% of the world gets schizophrenia. And one of those more highly genetic conditions. And cure is a dirty word in psychiatry because we do not have a cure for schizophrenia, right? Like not to say, like, there have been cases of spontaneous remission or cure, if you will, but, you know, we certainly haven't stumbled upon a medication treatment or therapy option necessarily that can just take someone from having that to not having it. So you can see where, yeah, we needed the diagnosis to study it, understand it, get people access to resources. And this varies kind of wildly across countries too, and how things are treated. But with that being an example of a very real and significant biological complex illness in need of a lot of psychosocial and biologic interventions, and we have not figured out a cure yet.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, but maybe it would be helpful to try to bring this sort of growth mindset concept that we're talking about to whatever hand of cards you've been dealt.
Autism spectrum disorder, ADHD, whatever.
Yeah, again, just trying to avoid the potential pitfall of over-identifying with the, whatever label you've been given so that, you mentioned ADHD. I remember in high school having a friend who was diagnosed with ADHD, and he would often say things, you know, he would do something that was really obnoxious, or he would do something really impulsive and maybe bully somebody else. And he'd get pushback and he would say, it's my ADHD, as if he was possessed by some entity that wasn't his responsibility. So I think it's can be really helpful and growth promoting to maintain responsibility for yourself, for your behavior, for your, for the way you impact others without self-shaming, right? Because we all have our own limitations placed upon us, like you were saying earlier, by maybe our genetics, maybe our upbringing. But I prefer the belief that, we are capable of transcending many of our limitations.
Yeah. And this is, tricky stuff, just to highlight again that delicate balance that we all need to land on, and with a lot of compassion, understanding, and self-forgiveness of self-acceptance and the need for continued growth and progress. You know, that middle path, it's hard to pinpoint, and it's kind of something that you need to find your own balance in.
Yeah. And maybe you don't find your own balance the way you find a treasure chest and uncover it and there you have it. It's probably a work in progress.
Practice.
Yeah, it's a practice.
Like a unicycle. Yeah. The other thing you mentioned that I wanted to highlight is you were talking about people looking ahead to that point where they get, you know, they do the work, they're doing, and get to a place, a signpost of being fixed or to the other side of it. And just thinking of how much of a mindfulness challenge that is, to really be present for your life as it's unfolding, if you're constantly feeling the need to fix everything.
Yeah.
And part of it is something I've been thinking about a lot lately is just the role of desire in our suffering. You know the saying, desire is the root of all suffering.
Our attachments to our desires.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
Yeah, I think it's pretty accurate. You know, I don't know the exact Buddhist quote or saying, but it, you know, I like to think of it as our attachment to our desires that cause our suffering. It's this rigid, inflexible grip that we have on our desire to be something other than we are or someplace other than where we are that causes us to suffer, right? It's why we emphasize gratitude practices so much. In fact, I did that this morning. I was having kind of a rough morning, feeling grumpy about a few things. So I had the presence of mind and the time to meditate a bit and just flipped everything I was feeling grumpy about upside down and found ways to feel grateful for the very things that I was feeling grumpy about. And dude, my mood turned on a dime. It was amazing.
That's cool to hear. This morning in a parallel universe, I was in a yoga class, sweating my ass off and getting to that end when you can kind of die in Shavasana and just let go and lay there. And then the teacher comes around with these cold towels, ice cold with like lavender essential oil in it. And, you know, sets it in your hand and it has a message on it, a one word randomly dished out message. And, I like to peek before I put it on my third eye sometimes so I know what word, just in case I get something totally crazy.
Yeah.
I haven't gotten one of those yet, but I look at the, this pink, nice smelling, cold towel before I put it on my head and it says gratitude. And so I was like, cool. And I just melt back into Shavasana and leave my body there for a moment. My consciousness is floating around. And all of a sudden I get this stream. It was just this really fascinating thought stream of I found myself, my higher self, I guess, came out after a good yoga practice and was just kind of reciting in my mind, I am grateful for all of these painful, difficult things through life because they gave me, and I was just listing them off. They taught me, you know, how to work. They taught me how to set boundaries. They taught me how to love and love again, even though there's loss and heartbreak. They taught me how to like, how to turn like pain into progress. And it just went on for minutes. I wish I could have written some of these down because I was just blown away with this kind of transformation of pain into like purpose and blessings and gifts through gratitude.
Yeah, it's an alchemical process, right? And maybe our spirit selves met somewhere on the astral plane, because when I was running through all the many things I was grateful for, I started thinking about the people. And I thought about you, Reed, and how grateful I am for you as a friend, as a colleague. And so, yeah, maybe we were connected on some cosmic wavelength. That's pretty cool.
Well, thank you, Steve. That's that's really neat to hear. Was this at 10:31 a.m. by chance?
It was pretty close, actually. Maybe a little bit before.
Cool. Wow, we got all quantum on this episode, didn't we?
Look at us being quantum.
You knew it would happen.
Eventually, I'd give
in. As the beard grew.
Yeah. But I do want to make one point about post-traumatic growth. So, you know, there are plenty of case studies and even a little bit of more quantitative research on people who have experienced some of the most horrendous traumas who then turn around and find gratitude kind of like you're describing. You know, I wouldn't have learned X, I wouldn't have become Y if it weren't for these really, really difficult trials. Most of them would probably say, or I've even read and heard them say, it's not that I wish this upon myself or anybody else, or not that I would, if I could do it over again, I would. Some people actually do say that, you know, paraplegic who said, I wouldn't have my life any other way. It's admirable and amazing and beautiful. I don't know that I would say that to somebody who's in the throes of their suffering though. Like, oh, like this is going to be the best thing that ever happened to you. Right. So again, if any of you are listening and you're feeling kind of activated by that, please understand the distinction.
Yeah. It's another one of those, another example of that, tricky balance of just really acknowledging and, not, skipping over too easily how hard traumatic things are and how much of a toll they can take on someone's life and how much of a crack they can put in one's self and identity. And, that other truth, because, you know, I think we've both come to realize that more than one thing can be true and almost always is, that there is growth on the other side of that. But first things first, let's get back on solid ground. Let's get some basic ground control, stabilization, bottom of the pyramid stuff. And yeah, you have to be really attuned to where someone is at and careful with words. I think an example would be like from, you know, generations past, parents, you know, just, dismissing kids' pain or suffering, just saying like, just get up and move on.
Yeah. You know, this might be a little orthogonal to what we're talking about, but it made me think of this recent podcast interview I heard with Greg McKeown, who wrote Essentialism and Effortless.
I like his work.
He was telling a story of somebody else who, I don't forget who it was, but wrote this tweet thread about their wife who passed away. And it was in the last 6 months of her life that, as he describes, that she entered into this fully embodied, loving version of herself and talked about how if it weren't for her imminent death, that she might not have ever really found her way to that place. Yeah. And, you know, of course he cherished those last 6 months and had never felt more love for her and she never felt more love for him. And
that's beautiful.
It's just so beautiful. So, yeah, it also made me think of the things that hospice doctors tell us about the people who are, you know, dying, people who are close to their own death. And I Googled some things because, you know, you always hear sort of the well understood things like, oh, people, they never say on their deathbed that they wish they would have spent more time at the office. Or they wish they would have made more money. Maybe there are a few people who say that. Mm-hmm. But I looked it up and I guess there's a book called The Top 5 Regrets of the Dying, A Life Transformed by The Dearly Departing by Bonnie Ware. Mm-hmm. And in that book, the top five regrets are, I wish I had had the courage to live a life true to myself and not the life others expected of me. I wish I hadn't worked so hard. I wish I'd had the courage to express my feelings. I wish I had stayed in touch with my friends. And I wish I had let myself be happier.
I've seen that list before. Yeah. It's poignant.
That last one, I wish I had let myself be happier. I think it's tied in a lot of ways to what we're talking about, because a lot of times when we over-identify with the brokenness, with the deep flaws, then we're not letting ourselves have access to what could be there.
Over-identifying becomes a problem when you don't let yourself enjoy the journey, right? Like at least one of the ways that it can become problematic. So yeah, I think that's a really good example to highlight. And something I'm trying to work on, to be honest, is just kind of finding, refinding, recalibrating, settling into that place of contentment and this radical acceptance and gratitude for where life is currently, counting the blessings in that spirit of gratitude. Like that's what I found myself saying to myself when I came out of yoga this morning was, wow, I really am grateful for the pain that shook me awake or that, you know, taught me all these things. Not that you'd wish that on anyone, or not that you'd kind of discount that by minimizing the pain someone is in the throes of it. But wow, you know, there is the potential for, like you said, post-traumatic growth over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we got to be patient.
Yeah, and part of it is rewriting our narrative, and part of how we do that is through gratitude.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, gratitude's it's a solvent for a lot of things. It carries us through a lot of things.
Yeah, but back on that desire front, there's something that, well, I've been working with lately, you might call the three golden A's of a certain kind of Buddhist meditation. And maybe I can share these and get your thoughts, because I think they're related. But number one is Acha, A-C-H-A-H, which means I want nothing. Because, you know, it's attributed to Buddha. Desire is the root of all suffering. But the, and aversion, the other side of that coin, like, you know, attachment and aversion are these obstacles to our present moment samadhi, or like pure unbounded contentment and bliss. But that excitement, anxiety, dissatisfaction, spring from us wanting to be healed fully or whatever, or fixed. And through this this principle idea of I want nothing, you get rid of your desires and clinging for it. So that's one of them. Mm-hmm. The second one being aprayatna, A-P-R-A-Y-A-T-N-A. I'll do / try nothing. So the sahaj means effortless. So the minute you try, your brain's kind of overthinking, kicked on board, and there's a risk of that restlessness. So finding that effortlessness and ease in the path forward, I think is what that's getting at. And then the last one, akinchan, I am nothing. It's kind of like Ryan Holiday's book, The Ego's the Enemy. The ego thinks we're lordlings, too superior to surrender. But with this, I am nothing, akinchan, A-K-I-N-C-H-A-N, you detach from your ego and open yourself up to, you surrender to, you know, so much more expansive potential.
Yeah, it's so, the three A's are so opposite to the standard Western mindset of accomplish, accumulate, become something, prove, protect, all those things.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why they are the antidote to much of our suffering here in the West.
You know, instead of becoming nothing or becoming nobody, these teachings would suggest, we all want to be somebody and have a lot. And you know, I don't think we realize what comes along with that, you know, in the form of, you know, attachments, aversions, and energetic things weighing on us.
Yeah, it reminds me of Amor Fati, you mentioned Ryan Holiday, like this sort of stoic principle of loving your fate. Meaning, like, find a way to love what is what you are, and what your life actually already is.
Yeah.
It's a way to not sort of get caught up in what you talked about, dissatisfaction and aversion and desire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can kind of see why. What do they say in Buddhism? To awaken bodhicitta, like the Buddha heart. Start with a broken heart. It's a scary thing to think about, but think about what happens in that state of like a broken heart towards whatever it is, like you know, someone has passed on, or you've realized how you've caused suffering, and now your heart breaks in awareness of that, and you've find a new way. Mm-hmm. And that is a starting point for beautiful things, as painful as it is.
Yeah. I love it, Reed. Anything else in that mind of yours that you want to share?
Dark nights produce bright stars, so stick with it.
Got it. Well, let's end there. Dark nights produce bright stars. Hopefully this was useful to you folks. Appreciate you.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. Always a pleasure. Appreciate you.
Psychedelic Therapy Frontiers is brought to you by Numinous, a mental wellness company committed to tackling the global mental health crisis by delivering best-in-class psychedelic-assisted therapies, contributing to the body of primary and clinical psychedelic research, and fostering healing through community connection and social responsibility. You can learn more about Numinous at numinous.com. That's N-U-M-I-N-U-S.com. If you enjoyed the show today and you want to support us, here's how you do it. Rate and review the show on platforms like Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Subscribe to the Numinous YouTube channel. Like the videos and share it. Share the show or clips of the show with someone that you think will enjoy it. Hey listeners, it's Steve Thayer here, letting you know that Numinous offers unique training opportunities for mental health practitioners to develop their skills and expertise in offering psychedelic-assisted therapy to clients. These courses are carefully crafted by Numinous professionals like myself, Reed, Joe, and others, and offer a variety of high-quality learning experiences. So, if you would like to learn more about these trainings, you can find the link in the show notes below, or you can visit numinous.com/training. That's numinous.com/training. The content of this podcast does not constitute medical advice or mental health treatment. Consult with a medical or mental health professional if you believe you are in need of mental health treatment.